Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast, coming from Dallas, Texas, Los Angeles, and Sacramento, California. Here's Skylar Teo, Aaron Alvarado, and David Stauffer.
Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast. Aaron Alvarado from Los Angeles, California, and Skylar Teo from Dallas.
There's a baby sleeping here.
That's right. Skylar is sleeping next to his...
I'm actually not sleeping. There's a baby next to me, though, but let's just get back to the podcast.
She's not sleeping?
She's sleeping. You said I'm sleeping next to the baby, so not quite accurate.
Based on your performance on the last podcast, you kind of slept through that one, so I'm just kidding. That's not true at all. You actually
did a great job. This is where this being an audio, non-visual medium sucks, because I have a pretty good mad face right now.
Well, to be clear, we are recording a video version of this. One of the reasons why I'm wearing my... I saw Dunkirk shirt, for those of you listening to the audio version.
And I'm actually wearing the free Dunkirk hat that I got, shining a spotlight on that.
Can we say that it's like morally very problematic that they made an I saw Dunkirk shirt and a terrible Dunkirk hat for a movie about like 100,000 English soldiers dying on a beach?
Whoa. First off.
French too. Come on.
Well, yeah.
Nobody cares about the French.
It's a miracle. I mean, they should have all died, but instead, so many of them lived that I think it's worse. I hope on the beaches of actual Dunkirk in France that they have like a little like souvenir shop that sells shirts that literally say like mine, "I saw Dunkirk."
Guys, if I ever find a time machine, I'm not going back to kill Hitler. I'm just getting an "I saw Dunkirk" shirt and then taking it to the beaches of Dunkirk with an iPad that has the movie on it and be like, "Guys, I know this sucks really bad right now, and like you're all formed in these lines that I don't quite understand, but check this out." This will all be worth it in 60, 70 years when they make a movie about this. That's awesome.
Yeah, your characters won't get names, but you guys are going to look awesome.
No.
We're going to get into Dunkirk. This is an episode all about Dunkirk. But before we get too far down there.
But before it's all about Dunkirk, something else.
What?
Much more important.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Dunkirk can wait. Okay. All right. Like, to be clear, Dunkirk happened 18 months like before U.S. got involved in World War II. So... I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that was just like the appetizer. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's kind of...
This is going to do like huge numbers overseas, right? Like, not Germany, but like...
Well, I hope so, because 50 million isn't super eye-popping number for a domestic, you know, opening weekend.
That's not good. And this won't play in China.
Like, oh, that's right. China doesn't admit World War II happened.
Well, they admit it. It just won't do any numbers there. Like, it's going to... This is going to be a huge loss.
It's going to lose a lot of money. No, it won't be.
Because what's it going to do domestically now? If it made 50
million?
No,
it'll make a ton worldwide.
Do you think so? Where? What markets?
Absolutely. I mean, Nolan has a great track record of worldwide box, number one.
Oh, no doubt. But this isn't like your typical, this is not Inception.
You're right. It's not.
It has very limited
global appeal. I don't think that's going to stop people from going to see a war. War movies do well domestically, regardless of who's fighting in that war. Like, China is an X factor. I think you're probably right. I mean, I don't have the data in front of me. I don't know that war movies do super well there historically. But internationally, Dunkirk is going to absolutely destroy.
I don't know. We'll see. I hope so.
We'll see. But it's the San Diego Comic-Con going on right now.
Where we are right now. All three of us are at
where
the San
we're
Diego
Comic-Con. We are live at Hall H, and that's what's incredible.
Yeah, we're on the beaches of San Diego right now.
That's right. Hey, look, there's Chris Evans. Hey, Chris. Put your shirt back on, Chris.
No, keep it off. Keep it off.
Yeah, take that shirt back off, Chris.
So we get the great thing about San Diego Comic-Con is that we get a bunch of news, but more importantly, we get trailers. And just today, I guess between yesterday and today, we've got three very important and interesting trailers, and those trailers are for Thor Ragnarok, Spielberg's next film, Ready Player One, and the season two of Stranger Things on Netflix. So let's just start with Thor, which dropped, I don't know, 6 hours ago or so. What'd you guys think?
Amazing. Like, the first trailer had me really hyped, but this is a second trailer that had very little carryover footage from the first. So this is almost 2.5 brand new minutes and all new characters. Like, I mean, we didn't even get to see Bruce Banner in the first trailer as Bruce Banner, and we get a lot of that. And I'm really excited for this kind of introduction to the space world that Marvel has. and seeing it through the eyes of somebody who's just an earthling, who's never been out there before. So that'll be really interesting to have his whole opinion and view. He'll be the audience proxy, I think, for a lot of the movie, but it'll be great. Tessa Thompson, a.k.a. Creed's deaf girlfriend, will be there.
Hard of hearing, but yeah.
And looks like Carl Urban, my man, has gained like 30 pounds of straight mass.
Is Carl Urban head. In that trailer? Because
yes,
I he's thought in it quite that a bit. Was Cate Blanchett.
Yeah, he's in the trailer, and he looks huge and bald. But just huge. Like, he's bigger than he was for Dread. And he looks great. So, I'm hyped. Goldblum was great in the trailer. We got to see more. Like, it is amazing to me how Hemsworth has just taken on Taika's personality in the way he's playing Thor. And he's so freaking cheeky and likable. Well,
you can tell. You can tell how much Taika's directing.
Oh my gosh, it's so Taika.
His performance and those lines.
Because but, like, just I'm just impressed that Hemsworth can pull it off. Like, and he does. He's very great. Funny. He's great. So.
He was the funniest part of Lady Ghostbusters.
No!
That was his brother.
That was Liam. Liam.
Oh, okay.
Actually, yeah. I think that was his fat brother from Westworld.
Fat brother from Westworld?
James Marsden? I don't know him.
No, Hemsworth.
Oh.
The okay. guy who, like, worked in the headquarters who looks like a Hemsworth brother. He's the older, fat Hemsworth brother. Which...
Okay.
This is my pitch for the third Kingsman movie.
Okay.
So you have the Kingsman. First one is England. The second one, they go to America, and it's the... what are they called? It's just in the new trailer.
I actually haven't watched it yet.
Anyway, it's the American Kingsmen. The third one, they should go to Australia, and it's the three Hemsworth brothers, and they're the Kingsmen in Australia.
Oh, because Channing Tatum is in
yes.
this next one, right?
Channing's. Like, okay. And it's Jeff Bridges and Channing Tatum.
Mm. All right, so Aaron, you just watched Thor Ragnarok trailer right before we started recording.
Yeah,
I just saw it. It looks pretty good. I'm pretty indifferent to the whole Thor character.
Yeah.
The movies are, I find, almost unwatchable. But that's like, you know, that's the way I feel about most of the Marvel Universe. But this one actually looks really interesting, and I'm somewhat excited.
Well, Thor 2 is among my least favorite Marvel films. It's really bad.
It's awful.
Is it any worse than Thor 1?
It's worse than Thor 1, okay. For sure.
Thor 1's fine. Oh my gosh, yeah.
Thor 1 had its moments. I mean, wasn't like...
Yeah, Natalie Portman had all the best moments.
Yeah, her and Kat...
no, but this trailer is actually really exciting. I do like the fact that Skyler mentioned they use all new footage basically for this one, which I think it helps to kind of clue you into what's going on finally.
But it also
you get a lot of Ruffalo. I love Ruffalo, so
yeah.
But it didn't feel like there was a lot of second and third act stuff either. It felt like we got a lot of the first act without them giving away the ending, which is nice because a lot of movies will do that. They'll give away too much, but man, Yeah, I'm excited for Cate Blanchett. Like, she looks freaking awesome.
I don't remember the last thing I, like, disliked her in. I mean, she's, like...
Probably Hot Fuzz was the last time she wasn't good in something.
What?
I'm kidding.
She was bad in Hot Fuzz?
I'm kidding. What? She was great. Like, her little cameo in Hot Fuzz was amazing. The fact that
you and I are on the same page that Hot Fuzz is the best Edgar Wright film, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that and Shaun of the Dead are really close.
I think it edges out Shaun of the Dead just a bit.
The more I watch it, the more I love it.
It's so good. And I still haven't watched it all with that Tarantino commentary. I got to get on that.
I have no interest in watching that. Tarantino's the kind of person who I love his movies, but I have no interest in anything he has to say as a human.
You and I depart there because I am very interested. I wouldn't be interested in, like, my daughter dating him, but, like, I'd be...
Well, unless your daughter's an Israeli, she won't be dating Tarantino.
With great feet.
Yes, exactly. Size 10 feet.
And they're engaged, right? They're not married yet.
No, yeah, exactly. Oh, he's engaged to Israeli pop stars. So,
I told Aaron about a nightmare I had recently about in meeting Tarantino. I won't go into all the details, but let's just say my phone kept ringing and it was Beemort who kept trying to call me. And it kept interrupting our conversations, even though I kept putting it on silent. I even turned the phone off. But, like, it would still ring, and it was Beemort. And I was so mad because I was just trying to have a conversation with Quentin Tarantino, and he was getting pissed that my phone kept going off. And I woke up, and my wife's alarm had just been going off for about half an hour.
Wait, so Be More actually calls you in your dreams?
In my dreams, but not in reality.
Okay, no. I was going to say that's more. Okay,
so I don't have a whole lot more to add on the Thor side, other than they're making, and I know this is part Taika, but part, you know, they see the success of Guardians of the Galaxy, but they're making a very deliberate tonal shift for these Thor films to be more in the vein of Guardians, which makes sense, especially because of the setting, because of the more, you know, the fact that it takes place on other planets and in space. But also, it just fits the personality of the characters a lot more. Not just Thor, but Loki and, you know, and everything else going on. But anyway, I liked that second trailer so much more than the first one. And I enjoyed the first one, with the exception of the line, "He's a friend from work," which I actually didn't love.
Oh, that's a great line, man. You're wrong about that.
I think it's a great moment, but that line, I just feel like Thor doesn't actually speak like that. Like, I don't know if he's been...
Then were you okay with the line about him, like, saying he lost his hammer a day ago and it's still fresh?
Because I
feel like that was the exact same type of speak. Like, those are both not just the exact same type of things.
It's both more modern, not Asgardian. But like, I feel like he could have picked that up from Tony Stark.
Right. But I think those are both things he could have picked up from Tony Stark.
Right. That's fair. All right.
So who wrote the screenplay? Question for you guys.
I actually don't know.
It wasn't Taika.
So you're giving him credit for the Taika speak, but
that's true. You think those were like lines that they were just kind of riffing?
That's riffing. That's Taika riffing. Taika does a lot of that on set.
Well, if there's one thing we know that the Disney folks don't love, it's that.
Because like, so
you never riff.
What We Do in the Shadows had like really no script. It was almost entirely riffed.
Well, look who's starring in
set.
It.
Yeah.
Taika was starring in it. With Jermaine.
Well, Chris Hemsworth is not... he's not a comedian on the level of the cast.
I'm not saying Chris Hemsworth's come up with these lines on set. I'm saying Taika's come up with these lines on set and feeding them.
Oh, so he's the puppet master, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. This is all Taika. Thor is speaking as Taika.
See, I can kind of get behind you to a point because I can see how it's like Taika. Where you lose me here is that like Marvel's never letting Taika doing that. Like,
dude,
never.
That's what is blowing my freaking mind about this movie so far.
But Chris Miller and Phil Lord just got fired for this reason.
Right, but I'm guessing he didn't go to the extent of having fart jokes or butt-speaking jokes.
More Ace Ventura humor?
That never happened, by the way. That's such bullcrap, but it is wonderful.
I love that, how that was like an anecdote reference. Like,
but just the visuals of this movie. I remember the first pictures that came out from it were... Thor doesn't have his hair and he's got the war paint on his face and all the color and everything. Like, it almost felt like they were trying to do Guardians too much. But now seeing the posters that have come out, it's so saturated and so beautiful. Like, it looks incredible. And everything, like the way they have done the title cards and like even the Marvel Studios title card, it all looks freaking awesome. It looks great. Like, I think it's going to be visually the most interesting Marvel movie we've had so far, and I'm very excited about it.
All right, next trailer, Ready Player One, which is an audiobook that I'm in the middle of. I know Aaron is finished. Have you read the book or listened to it, Skylar?
I have not. I just listened to the podcast.
What pod?
The Ready Player One podcast. They just take the book and then they just read it one episode at a time.
Oh, I fell into your trap. Dang it. I'm better than this.
You are better than this. You're way better than this.
I'm very much interested in seeing this. I really have enjoyed the book so far. I can say that the trailer didn't blow me away, and I'm starting to get concerned, and I hope it doesn't cause me to not finish the book. Aaron, what'd you think?
Well, the book is actually really entertaining. If you have any sort of interest in like 80s, 90s, it's actually mostly 80s references. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of video game stuff, a lot of movies and TV shows. So if you have any sort of any sort of aversion to like books that are really referential to pop culture, then you're gonna hate Ready Player One.
Yeah.
But if you do like that stuff, you're gonna love it. You're gonna eat it up. And so that's what I was hoping they would do with the movie adaptation, which Spielberg is directing himself. Big mistake number one. But
don't blast
I gotta be honest, I can't pull any punches here. I was completely disappointed by the trailer. I know it's just a teaser. I know it's just the very first things we're seeing about it. But for me, it just, everything about it, it looks wrong.
I don't
like it.
My biggest issue with the trailer is that like a minute of it is spent on them getting into like a NASCAR simulated race or something like, and it, they look like NASCAR cars. And honestly, it ended up looking like a scene from Spy Kids 3D.
Yeah.
Where they have this race and like they're going up in these jumps and stuff. And it just looked cheesy. Like it looked corny.
It really does.
It's like they didn't have enough time to do the CGI.
Yeah, you got Spielberg money, so you can do whatever you want. And it's just, it felt unfinished. Like, oh, I don't know.
I'm sure it is unfinished, but are you telling me that you seeing the Iron Giant didn't sell you on the movie?
That was actually kind of cool.
Of course it's cool. That's the whole reason you read the book, because you find that kind of stuff cool. But seeing it on the screen is just... Exactly, the DeLoreans. There's a lot of Pac-Man references.
Like Guardians of the Galaxy 2?
No. Even more than that.
No, like Pixels. Whoa.
Exactly. Not as good as Pixels.
As good as Pixels.
Guys, can we do a Pixels pod?
I was reading... we need to. Yeah, absolutely. Give us some more time so people can appreciate it, and then we'll do it. And then we'll do one on the Cobbler. I was on Twitter. Eric Vespi from Ain't It Cool News tweeted out after seeing the Ready One Player trailer at Comic-Con. He said, Spielberg's Ready One Player adaptation is going to be a big nostalgia trip. Prepare for the Snark Brigade to go after it with sharp knives.
And there was nothing nostalgic about that trailer.
No, but the whole movie is I don't know how much you know about the story, but everything is about this dude that was obsessed with the 80s, creating this virtual reality world that's absolutely chock full of 80s references. Like, that's actually, the actual story is about a nostalgic experience in VR.
It's a treasure hunt through a nostalgic world.
Yeah. So then why doesn't it look like that at all? Like, they could have easily made it look 80s and stuff. Like, make it look like the next trailer we're going to talk about. Like, have it be 80s-ish. People would love that. It's so hot right now. People love the 80s.
That's what's funny to me is I was expecting like neon colors, like 80s music. And I was watching this being like, oh, this looks like a bad Minority Report. Like,
yeah.
It looks like Valerian is what it looks like.
Yeah.
Ooh,
yeah,
burned.
No. Ooh, yeah, that's a little too soon. okay, so speaking of 80s nostalgia and referential content, a huge, 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 I would say... I don't want to put it negatively, but the Duffy brothers participate in nostalgia porn. However, they also participate in great filmmaking and great writing, and that's what made Stranger Things Season 1 so good. And the Season 2 trailer dropped today. And you know what, boys? I loved every second of it. I am all in.
It's a great trailer.
I love Halloween. And for this whole thing to be based around Halloween in this world...
And Thriller!
And like... 80s Halloween now, like I experienced 90s Halloweens, but like this is just I love it. And I love the simpler time when Halloween was different and like kids just went trick-or-treating by themselves, and because I experienced that much, and like Ghostbuster uniforms and biking around. I'm so in.
This is back when you could go like trick-or-treating and eat the things that you got that were unwrapped and it was fine.
Yeah, you know, like, exactly.
You didn't have to worry about that
before Bin Laden ruined everything on 9/11.
It's amazing how much I don't care about the use of nostalgia in this case. Like when there's a quick scene of the Ghostbusters like ghost catcher thing that's shaking, and just the idea that these boys caught something supernatural in that container has me really excited.
Well, that's the Ghostbusters sequel that we wanted. We wanted a prequel starring the kids from Stranger Things.
All males.
Exactly.
No girls. 11's not allowed to be a Ghostbuster.
11 doesn't even come until the very end of the trailer too, which is it sad that I didn't even realize she was not in the trailer till she appeared?
That's like, pretty sad, because I think they're kind of hinting at her the entire time.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I loved it all. I'm pumped, and I'm with you, Skyler. I love Halloween. I have a lot of great memories.
We need more Halloween in pop culture. Like, the biggest issue I have with the streaming world we're in now, where shows are streamed and then you just eat it all at once, you just binge it, is we've lost the holiday episode, which I loved. Holiday episodes growing up, the Halloween episode of every sitcom you loved, the Christmas episode, the Thanksgiving episode.
What
did
you think
episode
of the Treehouse of Horror, that all the ones that you sent you?
Simpsons. Look, yeah. Here's the thing: is I don't hate The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. I think it's fine. It's just not as good as BoJack Horseman, obviously. Oh, so
well, how can you make that judgment if you've never watched more than two episodes?
I've seen like 80 episodes of The Simpsons.
Oh, I doubt that very much, actually.
So, when I was at BYU, I don't want to out anybody here, but like we had a resident RA was a gay man, and his like gay boyfriend lived in one of the dorm buildings by himself, because like all the dorms were empty except two of the buildings, but they still had RAs who lived in the buildings just to like make sure no shenanigans were going down. But shenanigans were going down with stuff. The RAs. Anyways.
Did they quarantine the gay men at BYU?
Yeah.
Is that what you're telling me right now?
That's exactly what I'm telling you.
Why doesn't that surprise
and one
me?
One of them was obsessed with Simpsons and had every DVD box set of them, like hundreds of dollars worth of DVDs. And we would go over, because I just assumed they were both straight and just liked cuddling, because I was very naive.
Mistake number one.
Yeah, and then like when they'd make out and stuff, I was like, oh, that's fine. But we would just watch Simpsons, and I'd lay on the floor and be like, oh, this show, it's so good. There's no way anything will ever beat it, unless the show came out with Will Arnett about a horse man. And then, son of a gun, that show did, and... You know what?
So
I joke about BoJack Horseman.
What did the significance of the guys being gay have to do with the Simpsons thing?
Well, that's just why I was hanging out with them, because they're just two cool dudes that love the Simpsons, and they just happen to be gay.
I think he's trying to say that every Simpsons fan is gay,
exactly what you're trying to say. Yeah, yeah. Which is not a bad thing.
Yeah, good job, Simpsons. So, anyway, Rick and Morty's better, too.
So, true story.
Rick and Morty is great.
Creator of, the whole Simpsons,
the Simpsons
empire.
Yeah.
Just today at Hall H, they were showing clips of the next season and teasing its 29th season or whatever. And he had the entire crowd chanting, "Lock him up," in reference to Donald Trump. And apparently Fox, so 20th Century Fox is the parent company that produces and funds The Simpsons. Apparently they got a little bit upset at a joke that they made, The Simpsons made about Fox News. Because the joke was essentially like, Fox News isn't racist, but they're the number one program for racists or whatever. Fox News isn't racist, but they're number one for racists. And they asked them to stop doing that. And then that somehow transitioned into the lock him up chant, which just that idea, that scene to me cracks me up. It also seems a tad hypocritical. But anyway.
Groening sounds like a Russian name to me. I don't know. Is he part of the conspiracy?
Well, let's just say if you were to fill out a form for security clearance, you'd probably leave off a few meetings he's had. all right, I'm done talking trailers. We're already 25 minutes in, and we've got Dunkirk to talk about. And this is significant. It's significant because, while it's only July, this is... And I realize I said this about Baby Driver just a few weeks ago, but Dunkirk... is definitely, for me, my favorite film of the year, and something that I remain absolutely astonished by. And I'm really anxious to hear your takes and what you guys thought. I just saw it a couple days ago in IMAX 70mm in downtown Sacramento, and it was such a breathtaking experience. It really makes me wonder... It makes me wonder how the general public's going to respond. We talked about 50 million box office not being super impressive. It's a difficult movie to watch, but I thought it was a masterpiece. Aaron?
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I mean, it's right up there with the best movies that I've seen this year. Thinking back to the rest of Christopher Nolan's resume, it's right at the top. I don't know. I'm hard-pressed to think of a better movie that he's made, a more effective movie that he's made than Dunkirk. This movie just I came into the movie with extremely high expectations, and while I wasn't given the movie that I expected, I was given something that was even more impressive. Yeah. in some ways.
So I'm curious that dynamic, because it was similar to me, right? You come in with expectations that are built by trailers and things you hear and whatever. What were your expectations, and why was what you got better?
So I think what I expected was the typical World War II Saving Private Ryan experience. And what was delivered was, I mean, Nolan has said it himself, this is his most experimental movie since Memento.
Absolutely.
I mean, those are his own words. And this movie is definitely that. So you have the nonlinear timelines that are running separately, and then they overlap. And so, yeah, like you said, this is a movie that's not accessible to everyone, but in a sense, it's extremely accessible for everyone. You just have to have an open mind to it. And I think if you go into the movie with an open mind and accept that you're not going to get Saving Private Ryan, that you're not going to get Rambo, you're going to get the antithesis, where it's not character driven whatsoever. There's no backstory, and there doesn't need to be. If you go in with expectations, like a narrow vision of what you expect to see, then you might be disappointed. But if you go in with an open mind and just want the experience, then I think you're going to love it, like I did.
Yeah, so you referenced several things that we're going to touch on here. And before I give a direct response, I do want to hear Skylar's take, if you're able to. Are you there?
I'm here. I just have Eleanor is kind of getting a little cranky, so I might give you a take and then peace out.
You're fine. Just jump on in whenever you're.
Yeah,
I'd like to hear what she thinks about it. Yeah, Eleanor.
She didn't get to see it. She's not quite there for the PG-13 rating yet. She's only allowed R's right now, or NC-17. She really likes that Urban Cowboy. I don't know what her deal is. Although I think that's been downgraded to an R now. Neither here nor there. This was an exceptional movie, Eleanor. It's okay. Yeah, I'm just talking about Dunkirk. So, yeah, I talked to her like she understands what I'm saying.
She does.
So, yeah, the nonlinear storytelling, it didn't hit me for, like, the first 20 minutes, which I feel kind of dumb about now. But, like, because I avoided reviews because I didn't want to know that that was a thing. And, like, I wanted to come in with as little information on it as possible. And I was just so pleasantly surprised by it. And so, so happy with the choices he made. The fact he didn't make this as mainstream as he could have possibly made it. Like, I love Inception, but Inception's incredibly accessible, I feel like, too. Mm-hmm. This is not accessible in a lot of ways, and I feel like all those ways worked for me really well. I loved it. I loved those choices. I loved Tom Hardy's section. Like, those were visually the most incredible scenes I've seen in a movie.
It's outstanding.
Maybe. I don't even know. Like, just the craft that went into making that was incredible. And then to be able to see it on a 70mm showing in a massive IMAX screen, like, I can't even imagine watching this in, like, an Alamo Drafthouse type theater where, like, the screen's 20 feet, 30 feet. Like, that'd be terrible compared to... women. Go see this in IMAX. Go spend the money.
Hey, Skyler, before you go, can you just... where do you rank it with other Nolan movies now that you've seen it?
Only behind The Majestic. Or The Majestic? No. I'm thinking of...
Prestige.
The Prestige. Okay, so Majestic with Jim Carrey, number one, where he's in the Red Scare. Then number two is... Actually, I'm going to have to go with the Paul Giamatti magic movie he did the same year as he did.
Illusionist.
The Delusionist is number two. The Illusionist is number three. Then number four is The Prestige. Number five, Dunkirk. Then Leonardo DiCaprio movie with Inception, and then All Right finishes that my list. Then
Interstellar comes in at the very bottom. Yeah. I like that. That's good.
Yeah. So it's been fun, guys. Enjoy the rest of the pod. I'll listen to you tomorrow.
Have a good night, bud.
Bye.
All right. All right. We will continue. I don't think he saw the movie, by the way.
No, he didn't. His baby didn't let him see it. That's okay.
I totally saw the movie.
Oh, he's still there. Oh, no.
I'm still here, and I'm going to defend myself because I saw the movie. I love you guys. I loved it. You know how I know I saw the movie? Because that Harry Styles was so cute.
Well, look, I've got my T-shirt. Exactly. Aaron's got the hat. What do you have to say that I saw at Dunkirk?
My 11:30 a.m. showing did not have any swag. They just said, go home and think about World War II and all the people who died, and don't wear swag about it. And so screw both
of you
guys.
Didn't provide swag, really?
No swag.
Oh, that's weird. I mean, maybe it was just the people who saw the very first show.
I did get some garbage popcorn, but that's it.
That's good. That's good.
Actually, I didn't have any garbage popcorn.
It was too early of a showing. Dang it.
Cool. Okay, dude. Well, if you wouldn't mind sending me your audio file once you get off.
I'll send it, but no more talking crap on me once I get off.
No, I knew you were still there.
Is he gone yet?
Is he gone yet? Okay, bye. All
right, peace.
See ya.
So... So you mentioned a couple things about accessibility, which I think is really interesting. This is a PG-13 war film that, if I recall, when it was announced as PG-13, both you and Skyler had an adverse reaction.
Oh yeah.
To him doing that. Now, what's interesting about this is if you're making a war film and you're Christopher Nolan, right? you're at a stage in your career where you've had the success where you can have whatever rating you want on this bad boy, okay? Like, the studio is not forcing Christopher Nolan into a PG-13. This was a choice by him to make it PG-13, and it makes me wonder why. It's got to be accessibility, right? It's got to be the desire he has for more people to see it.
That probably plays into some of it, but I think...
didn't need to be?
Exactly. So my thoughts are that just after experiencing the story that he wanted to tell, mm-hmm. I cannot think of a reason for him to go R. There, I mean, yeah, you could have had a little bit more blood and guts, but even then, we know from past movies, you can have a ton of blood and guts and still be PG-13.
Yeah,
I don't know. The movie is very light on dialogue overall, and I think that's where a lot of the R-rated movies earn their R, is right with dialogue, especially in a war movie.
Yeah.
And he just doesn't even go there because there's not a lot of dialogue in the movie.
No, there's not.
I think this is the vision that he had in mind. It just didn't need to be PG-13, so he didn't need to push the envelope. I'm guessing, at least.
Yeah, no, I think that sounds right. You know, I don't think he writes a script thinking necessarily with a rating in mind. And I think he writes a script, you know, you get it figured out and you look at it and like, what does this need to be? And like you said, the story he wanted to tell was it just was PG-13 material. And I think it's great because it wasn't any less effective in terms of, imposing this sense of dread and doom and despair on the audience in different moments.
Yeah.
And it was pretty constant, you know, especially in those first two acts. I mean, there's not a lot of breathing room in here, both for those moments and the score on top of it that definitely drives that home so much so that it might be one of the very few negatives parts of the film, in my opinion, with a score that overall I actually really liked, but in a handful of moments I felt like was a little too much.
Yeah, the movie itself it's the most tense movie I've... one of the most tense movies I've ever seen in my life. Totally. There's, you know, we talk about edge of the seat stuff, and this movie is above and beyond any of the edge of the seat stuff I've ever seen in a movie theater. It grips you from the very beginning. That opening,
it
the
drops
opening
you
sequence,
in the first scene.
Oh man, the opening sequence it's perfect. I mean, for the rest of the movie, it sets the tone perfectly. It captures everything that is going to come after it. So, and it's like you said about the score.
It can be heavy for a movie that I absolutely love. A movie I literally called a masterpiece. Yeah.
Right. So if we're gonna look for any sort of weakness in this movie, I personally feel it's the score.
Yeah.
Hans Zimmer. I mean, we know what he's good. We know what he does.
Yeah.
And he's teamed up with Nolan plenty of times in the past. I don't think this is his best work. But that's just me. What do I know?
No, I think it was fine for what we needed. Again, it's just a handful of moments that it was a little bit too much with the ticking clock. And then it also affected some dialogue, which is a weird thing that Nolan is like has this reputation for it from Bane and The Dark Knight Rises to whatever, where Nolan just doesn't care whether or not people can understand what characters are saying. And in this film, in a different movie, it may have actually bothered me, but I didn't care one bit. In a few of the moments where I really didn't catch what was going on, and it happened, you know, several times, but it was never something that I needed to know, or like the gist of what was going on was clear. But also the chaos of war was such that's like, you know, I didn't need to have it spelled out for me. I didn't need to have every line of dialogue perfectly enunciated.
Yeah, so, and I think that goes to the bigger sound design that Nolan had in mind when he made this movie. This is one of the loudest movies I've ever heard. Mm-hmm. The amount of effort, clear effort that they put into designing the sound and crafting the sound, and it's apparent from the very beginning. There's a scene that I'm thinking of right off the bat where a German fighter pilot is strafing the beach, and it is absolutely terrifying. It's jarring. It's physically jarring, the sound that the fighter plane is making as it's coming down on the beach. I remember looking down at the lid on my drink. It was shaking from the sound. It's rattling. The sound is rattling, and it's so effective, and it's necessary. And I love the fact that he did it. Again, going back to the opening sequence, there's machine gun fire that it scares you. It's so loud. I physically felt scared.
Absolutely.
And I loved it. I loved it.
I did too. It's such an experience. Nolan filmed this in a way that puts you in the action, right? Like, you and I are never going to know what it's like to be in war, and certainly not World War II. And a film can only capture, you know, just a small, tiny, tiny, tiny piece of what that might be like. But the way he did it here was the most effective use I've ever seen in a war movie of making me feel like the immediacy of what was going on, where I was no longer an observer so much from afar, which is fine for some films, but certainly a participant up close and personal. And that's whether I'm in the cockpit of these planes, whether I'm this super cramped, claustrophobic boat space, or whether I'm on the beach following this character through the streets as he's being fired on. Which being fired on by completely faceless Germans. We never see a single German in the film, which I think an actual face or person, which I thought was incredibly smart and effective. But from the sound design to the way he filmed it was just, it was breathtaking and terrifying, and it made me feel so many things. And you alluded to this earlier, and this is a big point I want to make about something that Nolan did here that I thought was so ballsy, but it paid off. And that was against unanimous judgment, but against usual protocol, he eschews character development almost entirely. Instead, I guess in lieu of throwing you in the action, having you experience it with these people, and giving you little tiny tidbits of these people's personalities and who they are based on their actions and what they're doing, not through stories and exposition, which, again, something Nolan has been, people have given him crap for in the past.
Right.
Doesn't
Inception.
Do that here.
Yeah.
Interstellar is definitely an element of that.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. There's an anonymity to war, to where, like, these are all just kind of mostly, you know, brown-haired, white, British boys, you know? That's And while you have your, you know, a handful of characters that you're following, you know, you don't need their backstories. You don't need a perfect arc for all of them. But that the thing is that people crave their character development so much. And look, I say this all the time. I rail on movies like Batman vs. Superman about character motivations and like being able to understand what's going on. Like, so I know I fall into that trap of needing that crutch. So, cause that, you know, like the investment of that character to be able to actually have something to hold on to and be interested in. You don't get that here. And Nolan rolls the dice there and hopes that people still stick around. And he gives you every reason to.
Right. And that applies to my point that I made, that this is the anti-Private Ryan, where Private Ryan is literally about one guy who's the most important piece of the entire movie. Whereas Dunkirk is all about the mass, the troops in general, basically, which spits in the face of the way that American filmmakers have portrayed war, specifically World War II, for a very long time. And even through like Rambo, basically. I'm thinking of Rambo, where it's like one man is more important than anything else. And the word Dunkirk is just, it's the exact opposite. And because it's the exact opposite, it stands out. And I think because it doesn't fall into the convention, it can be problematic as far as being accessible for some people. Yeah. And I've read stuff where people had complaints about that,
Absolutely.
Where they felt like there wasn't enough dialogue. They felt like they didn't understand who these people were. They couldn't understand or they didn't care about the characters because they weren't given enough backstory. And for me, it's just like, I didn't need it.
It is interesting because I feel like he pulled it off. He was successful in doing so. I feel like most movies couldn't do that or should even try. But here, Nolan had a very, very specific objective. And part of that was not having an emphasis or focus too much on any one character or their story. But yeah, it didn't surprise me to read some of the reviews, you know, going through Rotten Tomatoes, even the ones that are fresh. If they mention, any type of criticism, it has to do with lack of character development. But I think this would bog down a story that didn't need it. I've talked about how I love the runtime, an hour and 47 minutes, right? And part of that is, you know, they don't add it with extra fluff. And, you know, there's not some campfire scene at night where someone talks about how they were a school teacher and, you know, like that's the job they're going to go back to when they're done. You know, it's just not, doesn't have it because you don't need it.
And that's more to the point where it's a PG-13 movie. It spits in the face of how the narrative is developed. The runtime is not conventional for a World War II movie. He basically just did whatever he wanted, and he had a unique vision to tell this story, and I think he pulled it off, man, as well as you can do it.
Absolutely. I want to go through some highlights for me, a couple of moments and cast choices I want to call out as I think exceptional. I will say, in regards to that narrative structure, the more people I talk to, especially like my parents, or you know, other random family members, people didn't immediately understand that the three different storylines, one in sea, one on land, one in the air, that they were on these different timelines. Even though you had the title cards at the beginning, it wasn't exactly totally clear that in the air was 1 hour, at sea was 1 day, on land was 1 week. Mm-hmm. And so when it goes back and forth, sometimes you're at night and you go back to being day, and there's some confusion there. And I would like to think that confusion is resolved, you know, in this pivotal moment, which is actually a moment that I liked a lot. I think it had, it was a totally earned payoff, but there's a moment when all three of those storylines converge into one moment, mm-hmm. that I thought was a particularly effective moment. It was exciting and thrilling to see kind of all three combine. Was that cheesy to you at all, or did that work?
It works, but I think that the movie does veer into a little bit of the cheese factor towards the end.
Mm-hmm. And this is where you and I disagree.
Right, exactly. So I think that it's hard to resist putting a bow on something, the story so epic like this. But he does put a bow on it, and for me, that's not. I don't particularly care for a movie that has a bow on the end of it. And he gives us one, and he gives us a character that was formerly steely-eyed, who is now in tears, saluting the boat as it drifts off to sea. For me, like that none of that stuff worked, and I just found it laughable.
I feel like if home came for you too, Aaron, you would also have tears in your eyes.
Sure.
Look.
Yeah,
I realized the schmaltzy sentimentality of what was going on, but because the film was so relentless, pulse pounding, and in a lot of ways sad and full of despair up until that point, it both felt earned, but also I will say the reason why I would argue with the point that it's a bow is that he doesn't end the film on this. Now, if that was the final scene right at the end and that's what it was, I wonder if it would have been as effective as the final moment, because there's still crap going on, and it cuts back right to the action, and it's not resolved yet. I mean, that was just one moment. Yeah. And I read a quote from Ty Burr in the Boston Globe, who I feel like he articulates it probably better than I could. And he writes, instead, or I should say, a streak of honest sentiment earned under the most hellish of circumstances courses through this movie and provides it with a spine and a soul. And I agree with that. There's these little moments. Now, that was a bigger one. Mm-hmm. I'll point to a smaller moment that absolutely worked on me. And this is when the shell-shocked soldier played by Cillian Murphy, a Nolan staple, he knocks this poor kid, George, and, you know, hurts him very badly. I guess we're going into spoilers. But, you know, he gets a bonk on his head, which ends his life. But he knocks him down. The guy doesn't know what he's doing. He's obviously suffering PTSD, which, you know, at the time wasn't, you know, they didn't totally understand what that was. But when he asks, you know, the son of Mark Rylance's character, you know, he asks them, is he going to be all right? And the son says, yes. And then Mark Rylance, he looks over to his son and nods like, you did the right thing. You didn't tell him the truth, because this soldier probably can't handle, you know, the guilt and the reality of what he actually had done. I thought that was a pretty special moment. Did that work on you?
Yeah, I thought that was a great scene as well. And I think that of anyone that has an arc in this movie, maybe the boat captain's son, because he actually we do see development from the very first, opening scene, the very introduction of him to the end, when he basically becomes a man after experiencing all that he experienced in that one boat trip.
That's interesting you point at him. I didn't think of him as having a big arc necessarily. Was there something very kid-like or something?
Yeah, I think when they shove off, he's basically just the kid. He's not really, he's just the guy's son.
Yeah.
And by the time that he experiences all the rescue efforts and getting going head up against a fighter pilot, I think that he comes out the other end as as a different person. So I think if anyone has an arc, it's, I guess he kind of does. But and specifically that moment when he when he doesn't judge Cillian Murphy's character for killing his buddy, basically.
Yeah.
He understands, and I think that's part of his maturation process. Instead of reacting like, you know, you killed my friend, he took his father's words to heart, and he mixed that in with his own experience that he just had, which is incredibly traumatic for himself.
Absolutely.
And he understood why Murphy's character was so messed up. So, that's a great scene. You know, whatever you feel about it, I think it was incredibly effective.
Yeah, and it maybe wouldn't be as effective without the people playing those parts. I feel like this casting is incredible. Mark Rylance, we're on record on the pod of being upset about him taking Sly Stallone's Oscar for a ho-hum performance in Bridge of Spies. He is excellent here. He just plays his part very sturdy and consistently, mm-hmm. and it's exactly what you need it to be. I think even his son's friend, the one who gets knocked down, he's played by, I looked this up, an English actor named Barry Keoghan, who plays George. I thought he was excellently cast.
Great. Did a great job.
He just looks like a British kid from the 1940s. And I thought he was awesome. I realized, like, casting Tom Hardy to be a fighter pilot seems like, okay, well, I mean, like, of course Tom Hardy's good in everything. But he is. Even more importantly, the other pilot that he's flying around with, I thought was also, you know, equally excellent. The very first boy that you referenced, you know, that we see at the very beginning, who's just looking for a place to take a dump. Fionn, I don't know exactly how to pronounce it. I think it's Whitehead. It's kind of a newcomer. Again, they cast age appropriate people in this movie. I thought he was really great. He had a great face for that kind of like, I shouldn't be here. I don't want to be here. But like each one of them had these tiny little arcs, cause he's kind of went from being kind of semi cowardly, to, you know, standing up for this French soldier in this pivotal scene where, you know, they're under a lot of kind of stress and tension.
Oh yeah.
But across the board, this casting was just exceptional.
Yeah. And the casting, I think, also lends credence to this idea that it's not about one person. It's about the mass. It's about all the troops, because they didn't stunt cast for anyone except for Hardy, maybe. But even Hardy he's wearing a mask for three quarters of his scenes. He's wearing a mask.
Yeah, exactly. So. It's not like they just paraded him out, you know, front and center in front of the whole thing. Like,
no, this is not Pearl Harbor. So that's another thing. Yeah. Like, how embarrassing the movie Pearl Harbor is. This is the exact opposite, where they didn't do any stunt casting, basically.
No love triangle.
No love triangle. None of the fluff. This is this is a movie that's, if you love Pearl Harbor, you're going to hate Dunkirk.
That's true. And not everyone's gonna love Dunkirk. I was telling you a story earlier.
I don't think so today.
I ran into a woman from my church, you know, and her husband went and saw it yesterday, and you know, her husband was in the Navy, he's like in his 60s or whatever, but they both walked out of the film, not because they were offended by it or that it was a terrible film, but it was too tense. It was too they felt like they were going to have a heart attack, and I'm sure there's probably some personal experience that they can relate to that, but it was just too much without emotional, any type of happy payoff, which had they waited for the Brana tears, hashtag Brana tears, they would have, you know, it actually was too late in the movie for them to have made it that far.
Yeah. Do you, you got to remind me, does Brana give a little poem? Does he say a poem like before he starts crying?
No.
Am I remembering that wrong?
No, I think you're definitely remembering that. They do repeat the line, I wish they wouldn't have. As you can practically see it. And he says, well, at home? And then he says, you know, what do you see? Home. It was a little, I mean, that part was probably a little on the nose. They could have had no words there. It would have been just as effective, if not more.
I just have a feeling like they gave Brana, say this little poem right before you shed your tears. And it's just like something about beautiful England and
oh gosh, you remember it more cynically than it actually was. That's hilarious.
I'm just thinking they cut that part out.
Yeah, oh, that's on the cutting room floor. Yeah,
yeah.
Too much.
That's in the extended cut.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I'm sure.
Because we know Branagh loves his Shakespeare.
So. So I know we've talked in text about, you know, you, me, and Skylar, some of our favorite moments, but of the stuff at land and at sea and in the air, is the highlight to you the stuff in the air? Is that the...
I think that's the easiest to point to, because they really, I think they captured so effectively, the dogfight scenes.
Oh, yeah.
It's the most exciting stuff. And I think, like you said, we don't really see Germans in this movie. So this is the one time that we get, this is the one timeline where we see Germans getting their comeuppance.
At least you see the plane, even though you never see the human.
Yeah. We see some fighter planes, and then also a bomber.
It's worthy to note, the bomber, I believe, was seemed to be one of the few CGI things.
But
the actual,
I think that was pretty obvious.
Yeah, in the one scene it was, but I'm amazed how much the rest of it wasn't. Like when the British soldier lands that plane, that's a real plane, and the ships are real ships. You know that some of them are actual wartime ships they're using. And I've read some stuff on Nolan talking about how they couldn't get the actual British ships from that era, but they could get the French one, and they dressed it up to look more British. But it was actually, you know, in service at that same time. I mean, there was a lot of painstaking effort to get the detail and historical accuracy right. And so seeing actual ships sinking and actual planes crashing, it just reminds us of what we already know, that practical effects just make a movie so much better.
Yeah, it absolutely does. It lends to it the credibility. The fact that we don't have to suspend our disbelief is, are we really looking at a British battleship? Even though we aren't. And that's one of the movie magic things.
Yeah,
I much prefer a practical effect where it's easier to have like a almost a feel to it. Whereas I know I'm looking at some sort of CG, computer generated imagery thing, where I just feel cold to it. And I never had that cold feeling except for with a couple of scenes here or there, but not really. So I appreciate that.
Well, I think Christopher Nolan has, in a genre that is saturated, a lot of World War II movies, a lot of war movies generally, but certainly World War II, it's amazing that he's able to craft something that actually felt fresh and unique and unlike any war film that I've ever seen. I think he wrote an excellent script. He directed a hell of a movie. I would say maybe my MVP here is Hoyt Van Hoytema, who is his cinematographer, other than Nolan, who's obviously the one at the helm here. This same cinematographer he worked with on Interstellar, this movie was shot, in my mind, impeccably. It's not the same movie without this DP.
That speaks to the relationship that you need, the chemistry that a director and the director of photography have to have. And it's obvious that these two have it, because this movie is beautiful. It's gorgeous from the opening to the closing scene at the train depot, which is a great scene, by the way.
Yeah.
The coming into the train depot is a fantastic scene.
And why so? Why do you say that?
So there's that could easily be one of the bow on the end where it's a little sappy, but it's not. And this is where I have to give some credit to Harry Styles, because his character is so disappointed in himself. He's so downtrodden. He feels like a failure. And he brings all that to the scene, and he grounds it. And he resists. His character specifically helps to resist that sappy bow on the end feeling, even though they're free. They're home free.
Yeah.
But he gives a really solid performance.
Even
so I have to give credit
giving
there.
Them the beers through the...
That was great. Yeah. I thought that was great.
It's historically accurate. So like I was watching all sorts of like Dunkirk documentaries and reading all sorts of articles. And the thing is, Winston Churchill was giving these different speeches at the time, and England was obviously very aware of the situation because there was a call for civilian ships to go out and grab them. But the soldiers felt this general sense of dread that the idea of them coming back was that they were failures and that their people would feel like they surrendered. Like the citizens of Britain would not be happy to have them back because they went out to fight a war and they had to retreat. And so that the general sentiment among the soldiers was that we're going to go home to people who don't want us. And the fact is they cheered them on, not quite to the point of if they won the war, but the miracle that so many of them were saved when in reality they really should have been. I mean, they were sitting ducks and most of them should have died. It was a miracle that they saved as many as they did. And so they came home, and I think you're totally right. It's a moment of restraint from Christopher Nolan to not have these huge crowds with like, mm-hmm. you know, with like
the swelling orchestra music that's playing in the background. It's I mean, we've seen it a million times.
Give me the newspaper, you know, the beers. And it's just, it communicates that the historical accuracy without going over the top.
Right. So that's a really powerful scene. And I love that that's how the movie ends. Like that's where it finishes. It's just such a great experience. It's a really great movie going experience. I was blown away. I cannot think of a director that's alive today that could do a better job telling that story than Christopher Nolan.
100% agree.
So
to the point that this dude in preparation for the movie, and not even just for the movie, he's been very interested in the whole Dunkirk, Miracle at Dunkirk story for a long time, that a while back he actually sailed one of those small boats across the English Channel just to get a sense for how long it took and what that scene mm-hmm. looks like, you know. And so this is a man, you can feel that personal interest and intimacy in the way he makes it. This wasn't just a script. I mean, this was something deeply personal. And for him, patriotic. I mean, he's a, you know, a British man, and this was a hugely important moment for Britain.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah. So this is a movie I feel like it shouldn't have been a summer movie. I think this feels like a prestige kind of award type movie that should be coming out at the end of the year.
So that's what I've seen a lot of people on Twitter and article headlines talking about that. Why was an Oscar, essentially an Oscar season film released in July?
Yeah.
And is that going to affect this movie? I feel comfortable I feel like it will get nominated for Best Picture.
But it has to be. There aren't five better movies that are going to be released this year than this.
No. They could have up to 10 nominated, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'd be pretty pissed if they nominate like 8 and this isn't one of them. But it may lose out on a handful that it otherwise would have been benefited from the recency bias, maybe like cinematography. Nolan should absolutely be nominated,
mm-hmm.
but even script and some performances. So, awards don't matter, but they do. And I'm bummed that they might lose out in a few nominations.
Yeah, any awards that they win, they've absolutely earned mm-hmm. because this is a marvel to watch. And it's why you go to the movies, or that's why I go to the movies at least. Now, I will say that I was disappointed that I would say 99% of the cast was white. So Nolan, he has to do better. He needs to address that. And if he could have just like, I don't know, thrown a Mexican in there for me, I would have really appreciated it.
Yeah. Or 1,000 of them.
Yeah. Why not? Why did the entire regiment have to be white?
Well, that's the thing is if you actually look up in like the history of like the soldiers, most of those on the beaches of Dunkirk were Mexican.
Yeah, well, that's what I've heard. Yeah. This is what I've always been taught.
I mean, we weren't there, so there's no way to know for sure.
Yeah, so this is what I was taught in my home. But then when I went to school, the federally funded school, public school, they said it was all white soldiers.
Yeah.
So what does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that they have no idea the actual ethnic makeup of Britain at that time. So
there was a controversy about the race thing, actually.
Of course there was.
In the USA Today. In the USA Today, their critic gave like an offhanded remark saying that people might be turned off the fact that there are no people of color in this movie.
Yeah, which is funny because he's not even saying that he is upset at that, but even the fact that, and I think he's wrong to even bring it up, but the fact he mentioned some people
might,
and he's not wrong to say that because some people will be, but some people will be turned off by the fact that it's lack of female, you know, and ethnic minority representation.
Right.
Like, it's funny because I get it. We're in the climate where, like, you know, we need more of that representation, more of our films. But when come on, you got to be smarter than that when it's a film based on a real historical event where we can actually look up what the ethnicity was. I mean, come on.
Right. And so, of course, there was backlash. All the right-wing papers attacked him for that, even though it was just a throwaway sentence in a review. But there's also backlash to the backlash.
Always is.
So apparently, this is what I was just reading this today. So apparently at the time of Dunkirk, this was the French forces specifically, they were at their end. This is right before they surrendered, and their troop supply was at an all-time low. It was basically the bottom of the barrel. So they had a large contingent of African soldiers, Indian soldiers, and one other dark-skinned race that were there on the beach, apparently. Yeah, it was. I think that it was actually Arab.
In France, I know there was a, you know, a pretty decent Arab.
I think it was like Moroccan or something.
Okay. Yeah, that might be.
Yeah, right. So apparently had the movie centered around the French units,
yeah,
would have been a lot less white boys.
Yeah. Well, and we only run into like a handful of French at the beginning that are trying to get on the boat, and then the one French guy later on.
Yeah. Yeah, did you like that? Literally every French person in this movie was a coward.
Every one of them was a coward. Every one of them. The only thing they wanted to do was just get off of there.
Can I ask you what happened, in your opinion, what happened to Tom Hardy? What happens to him?
Yeah, after he's made a prisoner of war.
Yeah. Is he made a prisoner of war, first of all?
Well, the fact that they don't shoot him immediately and they actually go to arrest him leads me to believe he's a prisoner of war, at least for a time. Because otherwise, you know, you just shoot him on the spot and that is what it is. Given the Germans' preference to not actually... I mean, there are some prisoners of war that they had that they did not kill.
Yeah, have you seen Hogan's Heroes?
Yeah, yeah, yes. They definitely had a reputation for not keeping around a lot of prisoners. And so, in my mind, he probably dies in some way, shape, or form while in captivity. But he could have lasted, you know, a few years longer.
Yeah, no, I think he was definitely... I think in my mind he tried to escape at some point, and they killed him.
Yeah, he never makes it back to Britain.
No, rest in peace, Tom Hardy.
Yeah, when that propeller stops, it's
why didn't he try to land closer to the rest of the evacuating soldiers?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Maybe there's elements of aviation I don't understand, but like, how much can you, when you have like no gas, no nothing, can you actually swoop back around and head back towards that area? You know, that's what's interesting to me. I don't know how much were the German soldiers starting to really encroach on that space. Was it even smaller and smaller?
Right. Yeah.
I don't know.
It's pretty interesting. I have a lot of questions after this. I honestly had never really heard. I mean, I've heard the term the city Dunkirk.
Oh, really? You'd never heard the miracle Operation Dynamo?
I didn't know about it. I really didn't. Yeah. Heard it in passing.
They don't teach it in American education. It's not like, you know.
They shouldn't because the Brits, they quit and they surrendered. So we only care about winners in America.
Yeah, Pearl Harbor are not interested.
Yeah, exactly. And if it's not in a Call of Duty video game, then I don't know about it. So.
Speaking of Tom Hardy, though, and the propeller stopping, one of my favorite shots of the entire film, breathtaking, is the shot when the propeller stops and he's kind of gliding along the coast.
Oh, yeah.
And you get this angle. You see the plane and the city and the beaches, and it is it's an unbelievable image.
Was that you talked about in the you saw it in the IMAX 70? Mm-hmm. Was that one of the IMAX shots?
It was.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh,
everything in the air was IMAX. The stuff when it would switch back to regular was actually for the most part on the boat with Mark Rylance. And then a couple scenes on the beach were not. But everything in the air with Tom Hardy, everything is IMAX.
Yeah, so for anyone that doesn't know, we were talking about this before. David went to see it in the true IMAX setting, the IMAX 70.
Yeah.
So I think I read 75% of the movie was shot with the IMAX 70 camera, which is actually 65 millimeters. But anyway, but for the other 25%, they do, what do they do? Like add
bars to it or something? Letterboxes it, yeah.
Oh, so it's basically like you're watching a vertical video on YouTube.
It's about as jarring as that.
Now, do they mirror the video on the sides where they do letterboxing?
Yeah, yeah. And there's big, big white letters above and below the screen that just says, "You won't believe this World War II movie."
It has the logo of the studio.
It's funny because like I've seen other Nolan films where, you know, he shoots several sequences in IMAX, like the whole opening bank heist scene of Dark Knight with the Joker is all shot in IMAX, and the rest of the film is not. So when it adjusts afterwards, you might notice, but you get on with the rest of the film and you don't really think about it. But because 75% of this film was shot to fill the full IMAX screen, it was very noticeable, you know, during the 35% or whatever. Or I guess you said 75%. So my math tells me 25% of the time. 25% of the time when it's not, it's like, oh, like I like this. That seems disappointing.
That seems very that seems very disappointing.
Like, might as well. I wonder why. I know it's a cost thing, but 25% of the just film the whole thing. I don't know.
Right. Anyway. Well, yeah. So we did hear about there were some technical mishaps on the set.
Yeah.
There's a great story about them losing a camera. And there's a scene where one of the planes goes down and the pilot is stuck in the cockpit. Yeah. And I guess when they were shooting that scene, the camera sunk.
Yeah, apparently the plane itself actually sunk a lot faster than the crew was expecting. And you got to think, these IMAX cameras are not small. And they probably had to put this very intensive rig, because the shot itself is shooting up kind of from the dash of the plane to the... It's a very cool scene. But once that thing started sinking, the amount of time it takes to actually unhook it, they just couldn't get to it.
Which is pretty amazing. I guess the way they saved that canister of film was to keep it wet the entire time, shipping it from France to back in the lab in L.A., which is an amazing story.
Apparently, that's an old filmmaking technique. If film gets wet, you can still develop it, but you got to keep it wet. And so they kept it wet until they were able to develop it, and that stuff is actually in the movie, and it's great. It's a great scene.
Yeah, I'm glad they saved it, because that's one of the best shots of the entire pilot hole.
Oh, totally. It's great. And it's just another reminder why we never shoot digital. Because that footage is gone.
Well, you could do like The Room and shoot digital and 35 at the same time.
Oh, no. Did Tommy do that?
Tommy Wiseau. He was a true visionary.
And he got $6 million.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think that this movie was such a technical feat that we're going to probably come back to it at some point and maybe just do a follow-up review.
Absolutely.
Because there's so many things that we didn't hit on.
No doubt.
But, it's such a great movie.
I can't wait to see it again. Even as much of a heart attack, intense film it is, I can't wait to see it again. And it's not even just the technical stuff. I honestly do think the actual script and emotional moments are effective. But we will also be talking about it when we do our top 10 of the year, because it will be in all of our top 10 somewhere, I'm sure. I need recency bias to stop being such a factor. Other than I won't walk away from the fact of saying this is a masterpiece. I will stand by that. But like, with given more time and repeat viewings, I'm curious to see where it ends up in ranking of the Nolan films for me. It very well could be number one. But I'm definitely not going to immediately say that when Memento has been sitting there atop the perch and has had a lot of time, you know, and a lot of viewings and a lot, you know. But it definitely is the caliber of Nolan film for me that it definitely could be.
Yeah, I will say that Nolan, he's an amazing director, one of the best working today. But for me, his movies aren't necessarily as rewatchable as some of my other favorite directors. But this one, I'm definitely going to give it another shot in theater, hopefully, because I think that's part of the whole experience, from the sound to the visuals.
Well, yeah, you have to see this in theaters.
Needs the experience in the theater. So
yes. All right. Well, we went a little longer than we have gone recently. Hour 10. It was totally worth it. And grateful to have Skylar and Eleanor join us earlier. man, anything else?
No, that's it. I will just say, if you're on the fence, go see this movie. You're going to love it.
Yes.
If you love cinema in general.
Go see it on the biggest screen you can find.
Yep. So. Loudest speakers, too. Oh. Sit close. Also, I would suggest sitting close.
Yeah. Yeah. You were in the arc light a little too far away, huh? In the cheap seats?
Yeah. Yeah, I misjudge my seat placement. I usually like to sit in the middle section there.
And middle wasn't close enough.
No, middle wasn't close enough. For this movie, I needed to be even closer. Yeah. So I learned my lesson the hard way.
Well, all right. Dude, thanks for joining me on the Saturday night. Of all the things you could be doing, you're here potting with me. All right, folks, that's it. Go see Dunkirk. And as we say,
hold on to your butts. Thank you for listening to the Brave Little Podcast. Hold on to your butts.